kind of think we're entering a period like the 60s and 70s, which is a rough period to live through in a way. It's disruptive, it's unnerving, you worry that things could go very badly wrong in the country. We probably came out of it stronger than we were, and a lot of great things were accomplished.
Coming up on In Contrast, editor of the Weekly Standard and conservative commentator, William Kristol. I am Ilan Stavans. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions. William Kristol is the editor-at-large of the Weekly Standard. After teaching political philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania and Harvard, he became chief of staff to Secretary of Education William Bennett during the Reagan administration and later to Vice President Dan Quayle during the first Bush administration. Kristol is a political commentator for ABC News and appears regularly on a variety of television programs covering politics. William Kristol, thank you very much for being here in Contrast. Let me start with a general overview of how you got into being a commentator for politics.
It was sort of by accident, like so many things in life, a lot of chance and a little bit of luck. I was a professor studying political philosophy, teaching political philosophy and a little bit of American politics, and I liked doing that. I was interested in politics, and I wrote a few things for more popular journals, even as a professor. Then someone I knew became Secretary of Education, Bill Bennett, and asked me to come work for him for a year. That was 1985, the second Reagan term. I came down to Washington and was in government for pretty much 7 years, a little bit of politics also, ran one campaign. So I was suddenly doing government, doing politics. I did that then after we left office, after the first Bush administration got kicked out and we all left the White House in January of 1993, did some politics for a couple of years. And then a couple of friends, Fred Barnes, John Podhoretz, came to me really and said, why don't we start a weekly conservative magazine? There really wasn't a weekly conservative magazine headquartered in Washington. And we started the Weekly Standard in 1995. That's when I moved in a way from being a professor or being someone in government to being a commentator. I started to do TV at the time, too, and that's pretty much what I've done for the last couple of decades.
Have politics changed dramatically in that period of time, American politics?
It's a good question in the sense that, I mean, one's tempted to say yes, of course, especially because Donald Trump is now president, not something I ever thought would happen. And all kinds of other things have changed, partly under the influence of technological changes. The media has changed so much, social media. The parties are somewhat different than they were when I got there. On the other hand, in the big sweep of things, Tocqueville were here in 1985 and then here again in 2017. He'd recognize it. You know, it's not that different in some ways. Still a kind of liberal, democratic, capitalist nation, still a great power, still fairly familiar debates in some respects on the Constitution, on how big the welfare state should be, on American foreign policy. I actually don't know how much it's changed, and I don't know how much Trump is an inflection point. One has the feeling that things could change more quickly now. The combination of technological change, changes in the society, changes in media, then just the accident, if you want to call it that, of Trump being elected, generational change coming. I do think things will change more quickly over the next 2 decades than they have over the last three. I sort of have the sense that the last 3 decades, to be in the middle of them was exciting, and one felt things were changing, and obviously the Berlin Wall was a huge moment. But after the end of the Cold War, I think in retrospect, those 25 years or so were not that dramatic in a funny way. As I say, if one was in the middle of Clinton's impeachment or 9/11 or the Iraq War, it seemed like a big deal, and it was in a way. But again, from a historical perspective, three presidents, each serving 2-term presidencies, 8 years in office. The parties handing power back and forth in Congress, but in a fairly predictable way and without fundamentally changing public policies in a huge way. I mean, it is striking if you came down from Mars again and looked at the tax code today versus 1987, or you looked at the deployment of U.S. troops around the world, with the exception of Europe and the Cold War, it's not that different.
Does it make it exciting to be a political commentator at this particular time where, as you're presenting it, we might be in a disruptive moment that is inaugurating a new chapter?
Yes and no. I'd say without Trump, it would be more exciting and less worrisome. With Trump, it's both exciting but also worrisome. 2 years ago, I would have said exciting. You know, new generation in certainly in the Republican Party and in the conservative movement, to some degree in the Democratic Party. New challenges, technology, globalization, those have been around for a while, but really accelerating, I would say. foreign policy questions, post-Cold War, but also post-9/11, and then post-President Obama's reaction to President Bush, and now where do we go? I actually thought 2 years ago, looking ahead, that this would be an exciting moment and a moment in which a lot of great things could be accomplished. I think it's still an exciting moment. It's more a worrisome moment for me because I don't think Donald Trump should be president, and I'm not thrilled about the Democratic Party either. But just stepping back for a second on the history, I was thinking about this, reading up a little bit on American history. You know, we do oscillate between periods of relative stability, 3 8-year presidencies, as I say, and, you know, not so dramatic changes in public policy, and periods, let's say the 20 years from 1960 to 1980, which were full of failed presidencies, one-term presidencies, unfortunately assassinations as well, huge policy changes in both directions, Great Society, but then Reagan, failed wars like Vietnam, but also laying the groundwork for winning the Cold War, perhaps at the end of that period, primary challenges in both parties. I mean, think about 76 and 80 and compare it to the relative stability later on politically. I kind of think we're entering a period like the 60s and 70s, which is a rough period to live through in a way. It's disruptive. It's unnerving. You worry that things could go very badly wrong in the country. We probably came out of it stronger than we were, and a lot of great things were accomplished. The civil rights movement being one of them, Reagan reviving the economy and then laying the groundwork for defeating the Soviet Union. So when you're in the middle of these things, maybe they look a little scarier than they do in retrospect, but of course not all of them work out so well as either the civil rights movement, you know, relatively speaking, or Reagan's foreign policy.
Could you compare the relationship between Obama and the second Bush to the relationship of Trump and Obama? The fixation, the reaction that each of them have had through their predecessor and the way they look at the world as a whole.
Yes. I mean, I think Bush Obama is a more normal reaction against your predecessor of the other party. And the voters often have that reaction, not just the presidents. You know, voters tend to elect after 8 years someone who's sort of the opposite of what they had before, what was missing before. And so you could say Bush was a, you know, straightforward Texan, believed in American strength and so forth, and very confident, and Obama was a more intellectual, much more concerned with the limits of American power and strength, rethinking America's role in the world and so forth. And stylistically, they were quite different, obviously. Trump's been Trump for a long time. I don't know that Obama had that much effect on Trump, really. The Republican electorate was very anti-Obama, I mean, too much so. It talked itself into a kind of frenzy almost about Obama. So, for example, Trump, who was a birther, who publicized the notion that perhaps they had forged President Obama's birth certificate and he wasn't born here, and who, you know, really exploited that in 2011, 2012, and fanned those flames, paid no price for that. No price for that in 2016, which is really extraordinary. It was a totally crackpot conspiracy theory. Everyone agreed after a while, pretty much everyone, that it was crackpot. And the guy who was a major player in fanning those flames ends up as the nominee of the alternate party and then as president. So I think that does show the extent to which the kind of sense that Obama had beaten us twice, even though we won the House in 2010 and then Republicans won the Senate in 2014, they couldn't make progress against Obama. They won these houses of Congress and then Obama still by executive order did things in immigration and other areas that a lot of Republicans disliked. And he won on some of the social issues in the Supreme Court. And there was such a frustration and sort of built up resentment that I think Trump did exploit that quite effectively.
And at the same time, there is a kind of fixation, at least in the first few months of Trump's presidency, in regards to Obama, the size of the inauguration, the Obamacare, not only because of the system that it brought, but because Obama had established it. Do you read anything deeper, more psychological, into that fixation of Trump on Obama?
Maybe a kind of jealousy or wish to, you know, be a bigger figure than Obama, than his predecessor was. I mean, he's also fixated on Hillary Clinton, let's not forget. So it's a little hard to tell with Trump what's driving what in terms of his psychology. But he attacked Bush and McCain in the primaries a lot. One of the strangest things about Trump is he ran against his own party almost as much as he ran against President Obama.
Yeah. You talked about Alexis de Tocqueville at the beginning, and I want to bring you back to that idea of an outsider looking at American politics. How valuable the democracy in America is precisely because it is a Frenchman who comes here and travels the country and is really actually thinking of incarceration and the jail system and eventually brings in and up all this other system with admiration and with certain reservation. I wonder if after all these years of looking so deeply at American politics, you and being an insider, as you compare it, American politics with the politics of other countries, Would you say that we are a standard liberal democracy, that American politics are different in comparison to those of Europe, to those of Asia or Latin America? Is there something unique? Maybe I'll bring you here to the concept of American exceptionalism. Are we also exceptional in the way we relate to the political system?
A lot of good questions there. I do think, maybe this is my training as a political philosophy student and just political scientist generally, it is good to step back and try to take a look at these systems from the outside, so to speak, as well as from the inside. Sometimes one does have the problem of missing the forest for the trees, and that's why I use the expression sometimes, if you came down from Mars, you would do X, and I don't know why I've gotten used to that expression, but I think the idea behind it isn't foolish. You know, it gives you a little perspective and away from the headlines of the day. American exceptionalism, it's funny, it's a social science term. It comes out of, I think, German sociology and then comes to America. People like Seymour Martin Lipset get very interested in it. But it was really answering a particular question, an important question, which is why was there no socialism in America? Socialism in Germany, socialism in communism in Germany, socialism in Britain, France. What happened in America that was different? And there are a bunch of answers. It's a more middle-class society. We had the frontier. We didn't have an old class structure. Lewis Hartz wrote a whole book about this, the liberal tradition in America. It's all quite interesting, actually. And I studied some of that, so maybe it resonates for me. So what American exceptionalism meant in a more social science way, but I think also politically, was, you know, we avoided the extremism of Europe. In the Cold War and post-Cold War, it also took on a sense of great power, guardian of liberal democracy around the world, and so forth. And that's related, of course. Now, I think Trump, in a way, cuts against the notion of American exceptionalism. Trump is, in fact, a rather European figure, and we elected him. And indeed, he's rather similar to some of the Europeans who've emerged over the last few years. But his whole way of thinking about politics, a kind of mercantilist, protectionist way, a little bit nativist, kind of populism, not much attachment to what makes America special. We've had this constitution since our founding, or almost since our founding, since 1789. We have a, you know, rule of law and things like that have been maintained here. We haven't had military coups. We have been a self-governing nation. We had one horrible civil war and slavery, but we're not like France with five republics. And Trump, not that Trump is destroying the republic or anything like that necessarily, but and he himself doesn't care about American exceptionalism. He said that, I think, you know. Putin's got Russia, we've got America. Xi Jinping has China. We're all competing, and it's all sort of everyone out for himself. And there's not a fundamental moral difference, I don't think, or even fundamental kind of historically important difference, according to Trump, between these nations. So I think American exceptionalism is important. I think it's a key part of American self-definition. One of the things I dislike most about Trump is that he really erodes that and doesn't take it seriously and doesn't understand that even if other nations do X, Y, or Z, America should at least think twice before doing X, Y, Z. And if America is the pillar of the liberal international world order, and it does cost us a little bit more in terms of defense expenditures or not pushing for every advantage in trade deals and so forth, maybe that's worth it. And maybe we should take pride in that. You know, this is an American order. How many countries get to say that, you know, human history? And that's a great thing. And it's a good thing for us. And it's a good thing for the world, honestly. So that's kind of the American exceptionalist point of view. That's very much the Reagan conservative point of view. And even I'd say to some degree, the Clinton Democrat point of view. It's not Trump's point of view.
It is often said, and maybe repeated to exhaustion, that Trump has no ideology, that he takes whatever is near him and shapes it and has this drive to succeed and to be the winner no matter what, even if that means that he will switch sides or sacrifice certain principles. I wonder what your views are on this. And I also want to know if, in that sense, Trump represents a different type of political candidate in the two-party system, where the figurehead of one of these parties can be anybody that will satisfy a certain base of that party for a while, but it doesn't have to come from the line of being a Democrat or being a Republican, because as long as you play into that particular base and you win, then you have made it.
No, I think there's some truth to that. Obviously, he's not the kind of Republican we've gotten accustomed to seeing, who really, you know, in a way, checks a lot of boxes on the list of Republican orthodoxies. I mean, there have been presidents who were quite unideological, Eisenhower, let's say. What Eisenhower did have was a deep respect for America, for what we've been discussing as American exceptionalism, a sense of American history. He himself was not, you know, did not have terribly strong views on whether government should spend 21% or 18% of GDP, whether, you know, how limited the welfare state should be, and so forth. social issues. He probably had a sort of, you know, middling view of those. But he did have a sense of America that was distinctive. That's what strikes me about Trump. He is not very ideological compared to Romney and McCain, though those guys, in a way, weren't that ideological. And there are Democratic nominees also, Bill Clinton, who was sort of a centrist, and you could argue didn't sign on to either of the major ideologies, tried to mix them. It's more the failure to, as you said, it's about winning. It's about him personally, the willingness to use any grievance to ascend for his own personal sake, the demagoguery. That, I think, is new. That is distinctive about Trump.
And do you think it's new and will disappear, or is it new and it's inaugurating a new way of being new?
That is the $64,000 question. It's not new in the sense that we've had many demagogues. Every democracy does. And some of them have been quite successful. Joe McCarthy became a senator, and probably for 3 or 4 years, one of the most powerful senators in the United States Senate. George Wallace was a governor and a third-party Democratic presidential candidate in the primaries, and then a third-party presidential candidate. We had Jeff Buchanan in the Republican primaries in 92 and 96. We had Ron Paul. The Democrats have had various candidates like that. So outsiders, troublemakers, people who are kind of far from the mainstream, people whose views I don't think much of, we've had all of them. We just never have had one win a presidential nomination, I would say, in modern times, and certainly not win the presidency. Is this like what the future of American politics is going to be like? Or is this a one-off? Is this just a bizarre exception, kind of a flukish victory? Trump's a very skillful demagogue. The field was kind of weak against him. And we go back to normal. When I hear myself saying that, I can't quite believe that. I don't think you can just go back to the way it was. Clearly, Trump will change some things. It might, maybe eventually things will change back. Trump tapped into some attitudes and anxieties and grievances that politicians can have to think a lot about. The question for me probably is really two questions, I would say, in terms of American politics in general. How much are we now in an era of celebrity politics? You were hinting at this before, rather than ideological politics, where it's just he's famous, he's good on TV, he's fun to watch, he insults his opponents the way we are used to from watching, you know, popular culture and world, you know, wrestling and so forth. And so that's kind of what politics is like. And suddenly it's not about, not that it was ever so high toned, but it's not about what's your healthcare plan or what's your detailed knowledge of foreign policy. Mm. So he could change politics in that way. And then he could change the Republican Party and conservatism in pretty fundamental ways, because American conservatism has been very distinct from European conservatism in many ways. It's been liberal in a sense, if you want to use that word. It's been constitutional. It's been not been nativist, particularly. It's had elements, of course, of that, but not primarily. It's been internationalist, free trade, kind of Reaganite, constitutionalist. I think that's been an important part of it. Limited government. I mean, Trump is no interest in any of those
things. Are you worried about that? Are you worried about the impact that Trump is having on Republican thought, conservative thought, and on the Republican Party per se?
Yes. I mean, I don't know how many thinkers are being influenced by him, but certainly policies are to some degree. Politicians are, rhetoric is. And you never know, do young people coming up reject Trump and just think, well, that's just ridiculous. That's not a 21st century world or America. I think it's a lot of that. Or do they say, well, that looks like a pretty good path to success. Maybe he's onto something. That is a huge question. And being president matters. If he had run and lost, someone like me would have said, look, this was a mistake to try this. He lost anyway, so can we please go back now and have a responsible conservatism? Once he wins, it's a little hard for me to say it was a mistake to try it. I would still say it, but, you know, people like winning, and it seems like the voters sanctioned him, and in a democracy, that counts for a lot. So I think he has a certain momentum just from winning and being president and having Steve Bannon as an aide in the White House. He's not there anymore, but and having donors who listen to him and having voters who listen to him, primary voters, and suddenly you get primary challenges and someone says, I'm the real Trump candidate, and that person wins a primary, and then the party does start to change.
There's another aspect that I want to bring forth about Trump, but in order to ask this question, I want to give you a little anecdote. When I was growing up in Mexico in the 70s, I remember discomfort that many of us young people had through the word crisis. It was used so frequently by the government that the very nature of the definition of crisis was being dismantled, because a crisis is an interruption of some normalcy. And if you have a crisis after another crisis, after another crisis, the very concept has disappeared. One of the strategies that Trump has is precisely to be creating a flame here when there's too much attention being paid to some sort of scandal on the other side, using Twitter, using the rhetoric that you were talking about. And it seems that we enter a kind of constant state of crisis and of being zombie-like culture, where we are being deterred from the attention we should be paying to whatever serious topics are, should be before us, into this pop culture-like distaste that he has for Hillary Clinton or for whatever situation is in front of him. Disruption seems to be his way of handling things to the degree that disruptions becomes normal. It's standardized. Are we entering a stage in American politics where there is such intensity in every moment that comes before us because of the rhetoric that we simply lose connection with it? We are hyper-connected and thus hyper-disconnect.
Yeah, and I think that fits in, don't you think, very much with social media, which Trump is actually good at using, and the way in which social media does seem to diminish our attention span, and it's whatever the latest thing is, and he's been clever at using that. Everyone gets alarmed and upset, but then you can't even remember what you were upset about 2 days ago. And you totally lose the distinction between serious things where he's really, you know, corrupting the processes of government or trying to make a fundamental policy change that may or may not be wise. And, you know, slightly offensive things that he said or just silly things or made up things about crowd size. He's pretty good at using all these distractions. What is the net effect of that? And one could take the attitude of, look, it's okay. It's sort of like, what does it matter, really? You know, the economy is going on, foreign policy is going on. He has a certain style, which is full of kind of blowhard and pontificating and, you know, exaggerating and making all these claims. But people discount it after a while. And what does it matter? You could say that, sort of like your uncle who comes to dinner and just tells you tall stories and exaggerates his role in things and, you know, loses his temper. But at the end of the day, the dinner is perfectly okay. And it's slightly unpleasant having him there. But the family doesn't break up. There's no one kills anyone else and so forth. Or do we pay a bigger price for that? I'd say the disregard for truth is a little startling. He so routinely just makes things up. He just thinks nothing of just claiming things that are just, I'm talking about judgments. These are just facts that are just wrong. You know, biggest tax cut ever. There's so many that we just won't even want to begin. That people start to think, well, I don't know. It's just people say these things. No one says really what's true. Who's to say? It's just a bunch of people yelling anyway. That's not healthy for a political system that is based at some level or other on the claim that we can have democratic deliberation, we can have honest debate, and we can come closer, maybe not all get there, but come closer to the truth about certain things about the world and come to some consensus on the effects of some policy or other. And without seeming too earnest and without sounding like that sort of a cartoon version of John Stuart Mill and that, you know, free debate always, you know, produces the truth and all that and light and clarity and wisdom and enlightenment does depend democratic self-government on some ability to discern fact from fiction, truth from falsehood. And I do think Trump does some damage in that respect.
I want to push you a little further on that. I want to go into the topic of the erosion of truth and the impact not only in political discourse, but if I can bring you to imagine the larger influence on society. It's no longer the concept of the day, but the alternative facts that was an important concept that came in the first few months. The fact that we also live in a balkanized political system where you watch either Fox or you watch MSNBC and you are getting the news filtered through the political ideology that you are choosing. That is all fine if we keep on thinking that we have two political parties and that eventually we'll have to come together in an election and accept whoever is on the other side if they are the winner or celebrate the one is on our side because we were the winners. But I am a teacher. I deal on a daily basis with young people who are concerned about the truth. And as a teacher, I bring forth the concept that there is such a thing as a truth, even in a relativistic time where we can reach the truth from different perspectives and people have different truths, but there is a truth with capital T. And one of the fears that one has as a teacher is that a certain message that you're delivering in the classroom is being dismantled outside on television in the political sphere. So are we, again, going back to Tocqueville, who could travel the country and bring forth a statement of what American truth, meaning American society, how America handled itself, what the poetry believed, what the clergy, what the political system. Are we at a time that we are so balkanized that the alternative facts really means a multifaceted series of truths that result in tribes that have their own systems of belief? And we have a leader who, instead of bringing us together, or at least hinting at the fact that there could be a common language, a common place of meeting, is pushing us to believe that we should pick sides.
Yes, I think that's very much Trump's style, and I think he's not a great respecter of truth. This is, in a way, the academy or the universities. I mean, Trump is a bizarro reflection of what's been taught in many leading universities by many leading professors over the last 2-3 decades, which is precisely there's no truth, that's simple-minded. There are narratives, there are, you know, perspectives. I mean, you have fancy versions of this in philosophy and in history, literary criticism, different points of view, sort of identity politics, identity thinking. And in a way, Trump has flipped all that, and I mean, in an extremely vulgar way, obviously. He hasn't read or thought about any of these things. He just has the notion that, look, if he believes X and if his followers are willing to believe X, then they're just going to say X. And if you try to criticize him, you're fake news. And he does understand the power, I think, of attacking his enemies, and not just attacking them as being wrong, but as being sort of evil, as being malicious. That's the fake news. It's not false news. It's, you know, it's purposely fake. It's not a mistake. You're not demanding a correction from the editor, you know? Right. And that turns out to be more effective than one would have hoped. That, I think, is young people have been seen the least attracted to Trump, so maybe that's a good sign that your students are not interested in that kind of thing. But how much the culture as a whole has been. And to be fair, countries have always been susceptible to demagogues, so one shouldn't overdo the analysis, maybe, or the gloom about contemporary American culture. Having said that, it seems to me, and maybe this is just because I'm getting older and I'm nostalgic, but I do think there's just more willingness to not read an alternate argument. There is some social science evidence that people are more segmented in their lives. Leave aside even whether they watch Fox or MSNBC. That's true, but that's a small number of people in the big scheme of things. It's a bigger problem if you live in a community that's full of people of similar backgrounds, similar points of view. You meet and you talk and you share these points of view, and you share them then on Facebook and so forth. And you don't really realize that there are people with very different perspectives. And I do think, and there's a lot of evidence that there's been a kind of sorting among the population, both in terms of what they read and watch, but also just in their actual lives, red states and blue states. When I got to Washington, there were, I don't know, 38 states or something. I've got this number wrong. But in 1988, which the margin of victory between Bush and Dukakis was maybe less than 10 points or 8 points or something. You know, there's a lot of the country was pretty diverse politically. You couldn't tell necessarily if someone lived in a certain zip code what their political views were. And now you get red states and blue states, or red parts of states and blue parts of states. Fairfax County is only 2 hours away from, 3 hours away from Southwest Virginia. And it's, you know, the politics are almost the opposite. So, and people don't go out of their way to meet others. And maybe there's been even some socioeconomic sorting. It used to be that maybe you got together with your relatives and they came from different walks of life. And now maybe there's a little more, the upper middle class people have upper middle class relatives and vice versa. So it's a big topic, obviously. But I do have the sense, yes, that there's less of a reality check. My father, you know, once famously said, it was just a quip, but it became well known, you know, when he was an early neoconservative, had been a liberal, sort of, more or less. He said a neoconservative is a liberal who's mugged by reality. A young friend of his, then a few years later, there were some liberals who accepted a fair amount of the social science analysis of the neoconservatives, failures of the Great Society and the welfare state, but they sort of remained liberals. You know, they didn't want to become conservatives. And Mike Scully, who's since passed away, made this comment that if a neoconservative is a liberal who's been mugged by reality, a neoliberal is a liberal who's been mugged by reality and refuses to press charges. And I think that's a very deep point, though. You know, reality doesn't teach lessons by itself. You'd think it might, and people like us would say in some cases, well, gee, the lesson's obvious here. You know, look at the supermarkets in Venezuela as opposed to the supermarkets in Singapore and decide if you want to have a authoritarian socialism or a kind of, you know, free market, low tax capitalism. But people can interpret reality in very, very different ways. They can refuse to learn lessons. And especially if the reality they're in is so cushioned. I was recently with a group of people. Some of them were pro-Trump. Some were reluctant Trump supporters. A few were, like me, more anti-Trump, but all from the kind of conservative side, upper middle class. It was a similar socioeconomic group. And what struck me about them was in their own lives, they're living integrated lives into America. These are not resentful people who lost jobs and whose kids are having drug problems mostly and so forth. You know, the kind of caricature, the cartoon version of the Trump voter. These were well-off people. People forget that Trump got half the white college-educated vote. It's not like he only had people with high school educations voting for him. You talk about their own lives. They were tolerant. Their kids had married different people. They worked in a bunch of different professions. Some of them worked for government. Some of them were lawyers, doctors. They talked very sensibly about their charitable contributions and the civic associations they were part of. And then somehow they would start talking about politics and they would repeat something they'd heard on Fox News or something someone had sent them on, posted on Facebook or sent them in an email. And it was kind of crackpot, honestly. It was a little crazy. How can these go together? But it turns out people do have an ability to separate. It's hard to right. put your finger on what it is. They live a kind of quote normal life, and then they're also willing to believe certain things that when you say, wait a second, does that really correspond with your view of America? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's a massive conspiracy by all these people in the government to, I don't know, do what? Have voter fraud or to cover up something for Hillary Clinton or whatever. Don't you know people in law enforcement? Do you think they would just do that if their boss ordered them to? Right. Oh yeah, my cousin's a police chief, and I know I got assistant district attorney, my son-in-law, and no, they wouldn't do that. But I don't know. I think in Washington they're doing it anyway. You know, there's a sort of willingness to believe conspiracy theories and to be credulous about things that people really shouldn't be credulous about.
You were trained as a political scientist. You are a history buff. Do you wish you had been trained more as a historian? How do you see those two fields in your life?
My mother is a historian, so I have some experience with both. I love political philosophy. I think that's reading the greatest thinkers. There's really no substitute for that. And I do think the history of the world, too, is very much shaped by political philosophy. Modernity is shaped by Machiavelli. Liberal democracy is shaped by Locke. If you want to understand modern liberal democracy, read Tocqueville. There's just no substitute for the very best thinkers. So I'm happy to have studied political philosophy, and I think they're very interesting, and they have a conversation among themselves across the ages that's so, you know, it's great to be able to kind of look in on, even if one can't fully obviously understand it or follow it, because it's a very high level. Having said that, I also do like history, and I don't like some aspects of social science and political science, which I think do tend to be sort of formulaic and deterministic and silly. Look, the ambition of social science, sort of, is to replicate natural science, which means to explain why things happened precisely. And also, of course, if you really imitate natural science, it's not just to explain how things happened, but to explain that they had to have happened that way. It's not chance. There's no room for real human will. It just sort of, you know, when you had these structures in place, this produced that, just the way a chemical, you can predict with 100% accuracy, if you put certain chemicals into a beaker, it'll produce this or that. I do think history is a more accurate way of looking at human things in the sense that it does capture contingency and accident, fortuitous things that happen. And I'm a pretty big believer in that. I think it's true of Trump's election, but I think it's just true of life in general. Tocqueville says, to get back to Tocqueville, it seems to be a theme of our conversation today, somewhere the democratic historians, because they're democratic with a small d, they don't want great men to influence things too much. So they want to believe that sort of things had to have happened because of deeper forces. But no Churchill, maybe the British don't stand up to succeed in standing up to Hitler. And if the British don't succeed in standing up to Hitler, the whole history of the rest of the 20th century is totally different. So in that respect, I think young people especially should read more history and maybe study a little less social science.
Your view of things when you begin or when you start commenting in terms of the political landscape is that things happen not because there was a determined force that shaped them and brought them to this, but there are a series of aleatory, accidental elements there that have to be also paid attention, bringing forth the freedom and the determinism that are so strong in social sciences, in political philosophy as well. Much of what happens to us in politics is the result of where we push it and not larger forces that descend on us. That's how you see things.
There are deep structural things going on. There's automation, there's globalization, there are things that no one person could start or stop. Maybe in some respects are almost inevitable, you could say, or in any case, once certain things have happened, they then become inevitable. But the reaction to them can be wildly different. The management of them provides all kinds of choices. I think it's also unhealthy, whatever the ultimate philosophical truth about these questions is, which is a hard thing, obviously, to know, it's unhealthy in a democracy for people to feel they're victims of fate in a way, just as it is in one's personal life. Honestly, even if one is to some degree the victim of fate, it's probably better for people to think that they can change things if they try hard enough or if they set their mind to it or if they study or whatever the right thing to do is. And so I think it's healthier for people and truer, really, too, for people to believe that they can take charge of things and affect things and that we're not just floating around little, you know, corks on a sea being carried somewhere by a current.
What is then the function of a political commentator in a democracy like ours? You bring to it elements of a historian, you bring elements of a political scientist, but you are neither a historian nor a political scientist. Most of what you do, and you do so eloquently and so well, is in the form of radio, television, meaning it is like theater. It appears before our ears and eyes and then disappears tomorrow. It is part of the nature of what you do because you have to follow the story and tomorrow there's a different story. But I want to see it from my perspective or the perspective of those who listen or view you. Are you a historian of the present? Are you inviting people to see sides that they haven't seen? What would democracy be without the political commentary that we have gotten so used to, for better or worse?
Maybe it is for worse, and maybe it would be fine if we weren't all talking. And I agree with you that radio and TV is more transitory than writing, and that's why I always try to write as well, and why I've always encouraged young people with the Weekly Standard, for example. It's great if they have TV careers, if they become well-known, get paid for it too. But they really need to try to keep their hand in on the writing side. It makes you be more serious, obviously, than sitting here talking like this, which is wonderful. It's fun. But, you know, in a way, you're given a lot of leeway because you're not revising anything. And so you might say something in a sloppy way and no one hopefully will blame you too much for it. I wouldn't over-dramatize the role of political commentary and I wouldn't make excessive claims for it. I do try, and I don't often want just comments and it's fairly obvious or in a way uncontroversial. Or if you're a conservative, you make a conservative comment. And if you're a liberal, you make a liberal comment. And there's not much what I would say would be no different from what 10 other people would say, honestly, and with a slightly different inflection or, you know. I always try to bring something to the discussion that's maybe not totally obvious. And I do find one of the things that I can bring, and I'm not a professional historian, and I haven't studied a lot of these things in great depth, but it's some sense of history. I mean, so much of the conversation is so present-oriented, and it would be as if Trump appeared from, you know, like a phoenix from nowhere. There's never been a demagogue before. There's no nationalist or populist movements anywhere else in the world. And just saying, here's an example of how this could play out. Here's an example from history. Here's what we learned from foreign policy, from dealing with Milosevic. This came up last night, so I'm thinking about it. Dealing with a dictator in Europe who's killing other people. Here's what I think we learned from that about America's role in the world. I do find when I say something like that, people do think, okay, well, that's interesting. Maybe it's a bad analogy. Maybe I've drawn the wrong lesson. But at least it gives people something to chew on instead of just reacting. What did you think of Trump's trip? I liked it. I didn't like it. Let's talk a little bit about the history of U.S.-China policy. So history, social science in the best sense, comparative politics, you might say, knowing something that goes beyond just the present or the here and now, either the here or the now, I think is very important. Tocqueville, to return to one of my favorite thinkers, maybe my favorite thinker, says, I think in the beginning of democracy in America, that he tried to see not differently from the citizens, but further, by which he means he's not some kind of Hegel, or I think that's what he had in mind, some kind of, you know, deep philosopher who's just like on another plane and is telling all these poor citizens who think they're making decisions, no, you're just part of a historical epoch and I'm going to explain to you everything that you believe, and it's determined by this and that. Look, there's some truth to some of that, obviously. But Tocqueville very much stays away from that. He wants to have the perspective of someone, as you say, a citizen in the middle of a democratic deliberation, but he wants to see a little further the implications of what you're saying, not just, gee, this bill helps the rich more than the poor. Well, okay, but does it help the rich in a way that will ultimately benefit everyone? Let's have a little go beyond the first step.
In that commentary, is the purpose also to change minds? Is the purpose to educate, enlighten? Is the purpose to align people in a particular ideological view? Or is the purpose simply to be a reporter of ideas? This is where we are. This is how we're seeing things. I am looking further because we're stuck in the present. And there's a need to look at it, what Spinoza would say, sub specie aeternitatis, from above.
Some of both, I would say, in the best case. I don't think there's much point just being hortatory and telling people, I think you should live this way. I'm not a reporter. Some people really are great reporters, but I'm not simply a reporter, certainly. But on the end, you do need to talk about what's happening in the real world and try to get as good a fix on that as possible. Yes, I am interested in persuading certain people of some things. Other cases, I have no particular recommendation or point of view, and I'm just commenting, you know, sort of like a movie critic. I think this was a good movie, and this one doesn't succeed as well. But sometimes you're also in the middle of the movie, and you're telling the director and the actors, I think it would be better if we went in this direction. So I think a mix of those is better.
I want to reach the end of this wonderful conversation by inviting you to look back at your career as an arc or as an arch, navigating and giving a sense of journey. You talked about aging a little while ago. I wonder in what way the aging that we all do, the aging that you've been doing inevitably, has made you see things differently. Are you more impatient these days because you're older? Are you more patient? Do you listen more to people? Do you listen less? Are you more at awe with what this country is, the resilience, particularly at a time when our institutions are being tested? Or have you become cynical with all this?
Those are good questions, and I'm not actually the most introspective person, so I'm not sure I'm the best person to answer it. I would say on the one hand, unlike many people I know, friends, acquaintances, I haven't had a fundamental change of worldview in my adult life. Some people really become, you know, go from being communist to liberal Democrats or the opposite, or very entranced by the possibilities of politics, and then they become disenchanted and treat to poetry or something. I haven't really had that experience. So I would say on the one hand, I'm not that different from probably what I was 20, 30, 40 years ago. I do think in general, I would say less ideological, less dogmatic maybe, less confident that I'm right and that someone else is wrong, less confident that if only we go this way, things will work out great, but if we go that way, things will work out terrible. Because when you look at America in particular, I think you see a lot of cases where things went a different way than I thought was best, and it worked out okay, and sometimes it went the way I urged, and it didn't work out so great. So now that's all within the context of America, but if you step back, I also think it's important not to go too far in the direction I just outlined and become a total kind of, well, you know, everything works out and who knows, because there are some pretty big choices that countries make that really are decisive. And I am more and more struck, not less struck, by the distinctiveness of America, by the fragility of liberal democracy, probably. That's partly a Trump phenomenon, but partly just, you know, thinking about history. You just take things for granted when you're growing up. And so I think a combination of maybe being less dogmatic about party politics and, you know, this healthcare bill versus that, but maybe a little more insistent on certain big principles and pictures. And in the age of Trump, I very much appreciate that we've had this whole conversation without barely mentioning Trump, so that was a nice break for me. But I think the basics of liberal democracy, I come back to that. I mean, which I've somewhat taken for granted from the point of view of political philosophy. They're not, you know, they're either not very problematic almost, or they're, or you see all the ultimate issues and deficiencies with them. And so just basic free speech, rule of law, tolerance, basic freedoms, you know, they're not the most exciting things to necessarily write about. But it turns out if you're living as a citizen, it really matters. If you're in a country where the courts are independent and the judges take their oath seriously and the Justice Department doesn't put people in jail or prosecute them for political reasons, and most congressmen aren't bribed or intimidated by the executive branch and so forth. Now, nothing's perfect, and there's always some of that, and that's life, you know. Free media, vigorous civil society, universities that themselves are friendly to a diversity of opinion. These are not things that one can just take for granted. So I've become probably more struck that those need to be defended.
It's been extraordinary to have you in Contrast. Thank you very much, Bill.
My pleasure.
Reading Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, the 1840 exploration of what makes the political, social, religious, and cultural system tick in the United States, remains an irreplaceable pleasure. The health of a democratic society may be measured by the quality of functions performed by private citizens, Tocqueville thought. He was impressed by the role that liberty and individualism played in the American Revolution. But Tocqueville was no fool. Having been sent to our shores with a colleague by the French government to survey the American prison system, he saw the defects that would not only lead us to a bloody civil war, but would threaten our future. Tocqueville believed Americans were so enamored with equality that they would rather be equal in slavery than unequal in freedom. He recognized that the American Republic would endure until the day Congress discovered that it could bribe the public with the public's money. And he was convinced America was great because she was good. If America ceased to be good, America would cease to be great. The idea that America is exceptional, that we are called to lead other nations, is ingrained in our DNA. But exceptionalism is not forever. It needs to adapt to changing times. It needs to be revisited. Generation after generation, it needs to be made conscious. The age of Trump represents a fundamental test to that tenet. Is America great because we have convinced ourselves we are? Do we deserve the adjective great because of the way we relate to one another and to the rest of the world? Tocqueville believed that the laxity of morals could bring the nation down. He believed the public trust in institutions could easily erode if the nation's leaders were corrupt. He cautioned against demagoguery, and he believed that it was a thin line between mindless populism and chaos. Democracy cannot be taken for granted. It is a system of government that needs to be defended every day. It works because people make it work. Its worst enemy is ignorance, passivity, and disinterest. In other words, its biggest threat is internal. Democracy at times needs to be defended from its leaders, who can be ignorant, abusive, and corrupt. Next time on In Contrast.
You don't want to carry the weight for the entire newsroom. And often when you're the only one, and in a lot of newsrooms in the 70s and 80s, I was the only one. And for that organization, often the first one. So you have to represent everything. From the United States down to Tierra del Fuego, you have to be the guy, the Latino whisperer, who explains everything, contextualizes everything, translates everything. It's a pain in the ass.
Ray Suarez on the next In Contrast. Let us know what you think about In Contrast. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send us an email to radio@npr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series. Our interns include Katie Chen, Antonella Dominguez, Delina Hadgu, and William Harvey. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.